Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to this, the first of a two-part set of podcasts on energy transition from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Bassam Fatou, who's Director of the OIES. Now, in this podcast, we're going to discuss the role of energy policy, governments, energy companies, and hydrocarbons in the energy transition. While in a second podcast that will be published in the near future, we will address the role of renewables, electricity, and electrical market design, together with financing and finance institutions, before addressing the key features of the transition and asking, some would say, is the million-dollar question, where are we and how is the world dealing with climate change? Now, just to timestamp this podcast, we're recording it on the afternoon of Thursday, the 7th of September, 2023. Bassam, welcome back to the OIS podcast series.
Thank you, David, for having me.
Now, let's start this first podcast on the energy transition by asking, how has energy policy evolved in the face of the energy crisis in Europe and, you know, a more fragmented geopolitical world?
Energy policy aims to achieve multiple objectives. This include sustainability, security, access, and affordability. Affordability is key even in developed economies, as high energy costs can hit households hard, particularly in low-income groups. Also, for many countries, energy policy is strongly interlinked with their development policy, enhancing the competitiveness of their real economies and promoting industrialization and technological leadership. I would say that policymakers, particularly in Europe, have for decades enjoyed a very benign environment, relatively robust economic growth, low inflation, low interest rates, globalized supply chains, and abundant and relatively low-cost energy, including pipeline gas. And as a result, energy security and affordability fell down the policy agenda, and sustainability and climate action to achieve net zero targets became the main focus of policymakers. One of the major impacts of the Russia-Ukraine war, but more generally the rise in global geopolitical tensions, has been the revisiting of these priorities. Affordability and security of supply are now dominant in energy policy. And with this refocusing, important dimensions have come into focus. This includes, for instance, the trade-offs involved in achieving the multiple objectives of energy policy, the role of governments versus markets, the role of hydrocarbons in the future energy mix, the provision of finance to enable the transition, especially for developing economies, the rise of industrial policy and its links with green policies, also coordination and cooperation on climate action in a geopolitically fragmented world.
Now, Bassam, one of the aspects you mentioned is the trade-off between the different energy policy objectives. So, why do these arise and what shape do they take?
Given the multiple objectives that energy policy aims to achieve, there are bound to be trade-offs, at least in the short term, and these trade-offs can take various forms in different regions. For instance, diversification of energy supplies enhances security, but it could impact affordability and competitiveness by increasing the cost of energy. Europe has been successful so far in replacing the loss of Russian pipeline gas, but this has come at a higher cost due to reduced availability of global gas supply as European buyers avoid Russian pipeline gas and opt instead for greater LNG imports. This shift required investment in new LNG import infrastructure, creating lock-in effects. Once these assets are in place, there's a strong incentive to use them for their full operational life, which could delay transition plans. Also, in 2022, as gas prices reached record levels, there has been fuel substitution in Europe towards coal and diesel from gas, resulting in an increase in greenhouse gas emissions. Of course, in emerging economies, the trade-offs take a different shape. Their priorities differ, with affordability and energy access in many countries acting as the key drivers of energy policy. For instance, as LNG prices increased, as Europe sucked more LNG cargoes, coal has seen a resurgence in many parts in Asia as a secure and cheaper source of energy.
Now, Bassam, picking up on the affordability aspect that you referred to, now, how does affordability shape the nature of these trade-offs?
Higher energy prices are needed to send signals to consumers, whether households or businesses, to rationalize demand and induce changes in consumers' behavior. But higher energy costs also increase the burden on businesses and households, and this has important implications on their decisions. For instance, faced with budget constraints, households may decide to delay or avoid altogether investment in energy-efficient appliances, heat pumps, electric cars, and solar installations. Also, if businesses and households are burdened with large increases in energy costs, there might be resistance to further energy price hikes, which are often associated with green policies. And this could weaken the support for such policies. People often give priority to immediate economic concerns over longer-term environmental objectives during hard economic times. And this is why it is important to have mechanisms put in place to shield consumers, especially those in low-income brackets, as they spend a larger share of their budget on energy. And this calls for targeted transfers to lower-income households. And of course, in many developing countries where incomes are low and energy access is still a major issue, affordability is even more important than in the developed world. In these countries, priorities are first, access to energy, affordability, second, security, and third, sustainability, in that order.
Now, what about the effects of trade-offs, you know, on the longer-term picture? Because surely the current energy shocks has increased the incentives to accelerate the energy transition, hasn't it? And a kind of a greater move away from hydrocarbons.
The trade-offs between the different energy policy objectives could become less acute in the longer term. And concerns about the security of hydrocarbon supplies combined with the drive to reduce emissions will accelerate investment in renewables, particularly in the EU. But the speed of the transition will differ across regions, as the starting points in terms of energy consumption and energy access, the resource endowments, and the financial and technological capabilities vary widely across the globe. So the idea that all countries will have one path and will decarbonize at the same pace is unrealistic. Also, that the idea that as we transition, all the issues of security, reliability, affordability will no longer be relevant is also quite simplistic. The transition will create its own challenges and risks. And it's important, as we transition, the new emerging energy systems are resilient, secure, reliable, and affordable. For instance, reliance on the minerals and new supply chains, which are essential for the transition, raises their own sustainability and security issues, given the degree of concentration visible in energy supply chains, where China remains the dominant player by far. Also, the project development lead times in minerals, such as lithium mines, are even longer than oil and gas and require timely investment. But David, here it's important to stress that the challenges and risks associated with minerals are very different in nature with those associated with hydrocarbons. In oil and gas, continuous and uninterrupted trade flows is a dominant feature, and any interruption will cause oil and gas prices to increase, and the impact is felt immediately on businesses and consumers, either in terms of availability of the fuel or in terms of its price. For minerals, any interruption, say in lithium supplies, will increase the price of new supplies, say to automakers, and increase the price of new electric vehicles, but will not impact those who already own and are driving these cars. But such interruptions will have huge impacts on the cost and the speed of the transition and the rate of deployment. So the issues and impacts are different and require different policy responses, but the concerns about security, reliability will not go away.
Now, Bassam, on the theme of hydrocarbons themselves, one of the dimensions you mentioned is the role of hydrocarbons. So do you think that there is a kind of reconsideration about that role that will play out in the energy transition?
It's becoming increasingly evident that oil and gas will remain part of the global energy mix in most regions of the world for the foreseeable future. First, there is the scale issue. The current energy system is massive. And despite the rapid growth in renewables, it's still largely dependent on hydrocarbons. There are path dependency effects. Substituting oil and gas in its current uses in the various sectors at an accelerated pace faces various challenges. The infrastructure built around hydrocarbons is large, economical, reliable, and operational, with the average age for some infrastructure is only a few years, which give the incentive to continue to use the existing infrastructure. Also, the capital stock turnover is slow, and the equipment used by industries and households, such as cars and boilers, will take time to replace. And the issue is not only substituting the current use of oil and gas in various sectors, but also meeting the rise in demand, as many people still lack access to modern forms of energy, and energy demand still rising due to factors such as population growth, economic growth, and improvements in income. And this includes demand growth for oil and gas. Consumer behaviors are not changing fast enough to make a huge immediate dent on the demand for these fuels. Many are projecting that oil demand and gas demand will peak within this decade, but there is large uncertainty around the timing of the peak and the pace of decline when the peak is reached. Will the decline, for instance, be gradual or very sharp? Views differ widely on that. So really, the question to me is that if oil and gas is to remain part of the energy mix, the key issue then becomes how to reduce emissions from hydrocarbon-related activities. In the past, the guiding principle for oil and gas exporters and companies was relatively simple: to ensure affordable, sufficient, and reliable flow of hydrocarbons. And the competition between players was mainly measured by operational efficiency, capital discipline, and ability to replenish reserves. Nowadays, there is another dimension for competition: lowering the carbon footprint of their operations. Achieving low emission intensive oil and gas production will become a key area of competition and key component for the license to operate. And this requires heavy investment in areas such as electrification of platforms, reducing venting and gas flaring, carbon capture and storage, and the development of low carbon fuels in the aviation and transport sector. This also requires developing and harmonizing standards for measuring, monitoring, reporting, and verifying emissions. There has been progress made in the MRV area, but the landscape remains fragmented, which makes it actually very difficult to measure performance in this area over time and between companies and countries.
So, Bassam, you know, how are these factors therefore impacting energy companies' behaviors?
Well, companies recognize that they need to decarbonize their activities, and not just decarbonize. There is a societal and government expectation for a very accelerated transition and decarbonization. But at the same time, the demand for the conventional fuels such as oil and gas continues to grow. So the challenge really is how to meet the increased demand for conventional fuels, scale up renewables and decarbonization technologies such as CCS and direct air capture and green hydrogen, and meet the expectation of stakeholders of rapid acceleration, while at the same time remain competitive and profitable for their investors and shareholders. And really, this requires massive transformations in energy companies' operations, which will impact every aspect of their business, including capital allocation decisions, developing new business models, increased transparency, more disclosure and reporting of greenhouse gas emissions, active engagement with society and governments, and create incentives to attract young talent. Business as usual are simply not an option for these companies.
So how do you therefore think this could impact on the capital allocation decisions that are being made by the international energy companies?
In this current environment, international energy companies are generating very healthy cash flows. And part of these cash flows will be diverted towards investments in oil and gas projects, as the demand for oil and gas is still there. But there are also expectations that companies must allocate much larger part of their cash flows and capex budget to clean technologies such as renewables, solar and wind, also technologies that would help reduce their emissions and carbon footprint, such as CCS and direct air capture. The amount of capital allocated by the international energy companies to these technologies has become a key metric for many NGOs. And really, the challenge is how to allocate cash flows to these projects at an accelerated rate while achieve attractive returns to their shareholders. And if the alternative opportunities in the clean technology space are limited, and investment in hydrocarbons are not particularly rewarded by investors because of fears that investment in new projects increase the risk of stranded assets, then companies will use these high cash flows to reduce debt, return money to shareholders through buybacks and dividends, a trend that we have seen in this cycle. This has the advantage of making the energy firms more resilient in terms of lowering their leverage ratios and making these companies more attractive for investors and shareholders. Of course, for many observers, this is a signal that companies are not doing enough to decarbonize their activities and they are not transforming their activities and operations fast enough. But from companies' perspective, this is seen as ensuring that capital is not destroyed in projects that don't meet their profitability criteria and where scale has not yet been achieved. And companies' approaches to this challenge are slightly varied. Some are venturing into new activities, such as the provision of retail electricity and investing in wind and solar, a new business line, such as electric charging, while others are more focused on their core oil and gas activities and investing in technologies that reduce gas flaring, their methane and CO2 emissions, and to reduce their carbon footprint in the hope that this will become a key area of competitiveness as the transition accelerates.
Now, you've mentioned carbon capture and storage, CCS, a few times. Now, many people are kind of critical about its contribution to net zero targets. So, you know, could you share with our listeners, what are your thoughts?
Well, for some energy-intensive, hard-to-abate sectors, such as steel and cement, technical options to reduce emissions without CCS are currently very limited. Also, given that oil and gas are projected to remain part of the energy mix, the deployment of CCS is needed to help achieve the goal of net zero emissions. Most scenarios of the 2018 IPCC report assume significant deployment of CCS. Otherwise, it would not be possible to limit the temperature rise to 1.5 degrees. Studies have also shown that CCS could also reduce the cost of meeting climate targets. Also, there is a scale issue. Because of the scale with which it could be applied, CCS could be a critical technology to achieve global climate goals. But David, I think there are also additional reasons. An area that I look at is the transition policies of oil and gas exporters. And I've always argued that CCS should constitute a key pillar in their strategy. Especially this is an area that they could establish competitive advantage, given their geological storage capacities, their access to depleted hydrocarbon reservoirs, and their existing infrastructure, but also given their technical resources, for example, their expertise in subsurface technology. So the deployment of CCS could really provide these countries with an opportunity to contribute to climate change action.
So is there, therefore, a role for governments to accelerate the transition? And how do you see the role of government interventions and, indeed, government support evolving in the future?
The role of government is key. And in fact, government policies are a key driver of the current energy transition, especially if we are to achieve an accelerated transition. But the role of government is complex. For instance, one important application of the changes in energy policy priorities recently is that we have seen a swing away from markets towards a greater role of the state in energy markets. Governments have been taking measures to offset the impact of shocks on consumers and businesses and have been introducing costly support packages, which is impacting their fiscal balances. Some countries have introduced windfall taxes and levies to finance the support and subsidy packages. In some countries, some energy assets were nationalized. In gas markets, the EU has imposed price caps and introduce policies for joint purchasing of gas. There are also calls for redesigning the electricity markets in Europe and the UK. More generally, this raises a key question, you know, how long will this swing away from markets continue? And if governments realize that climate targets are not being met, will we see more government intervention? And what forms of government intervention are we to expect? And I would say that this is a key risk for all players in the energy sector, being companies, investors, and shareholders.
What are the, you know, the potential impacts of such interventions? Are they all good or are there some negative impacts?
Some of government interventions in response to the Russia-Ukraine war increase the policy risk and the uncertainty facing investors, which could impact long-term investment decisions, but also how markets operate. But as discussed before, in the face of the crisis, direct government support was essential in building out the infrastructure needed to reduce reliance on pipeline gas and thereby increase security. Also, as the share of renewables and hydrogen increase in the energy mix, and as more sectors become electrified, the issue of reliability and security should remain the focus of policymakers. When gas and oil expanded its infrastructure, the oil and gas industry was profitable, which allowed the players to invest in supply chains and infrastructure and made it more resilient over time. This is not yet the case for hydrogen, for instance. For clean hydrogen to play a reliable and increasing role in the energy mix, and for the supply chains to develop, enabling business models through government support mechanisms is key to attract private investment at the scale and the speed required to meet the net zero targets by 2050. The same applies for CCS, where the revenue streams remain very limited without government support and carbon pricing. However, this increases the risk of governments picking winners and favoring certain paths, even if they are not the most competitive or ready for commercial application. For instance, advancing green hydrogen at the expense of blue hydrogen, though blue hydrogen is expected to play a key role in the transition. Also, poorly designed subsidies or intervention can distort energy markets, sometimes leading to unintended consequences. For instance, we could end up with renewable energy overproduction, but without sufficient demand or storage or transmission networks. What is adding to the complexity is also the rise of industrial policy.
So, Bassam, you know, you mentioned industrial policy, and of course, we're increasingly witnessing a rise in this policies in many parts of the world. So do you think this trend's going to continue? And also, you know, what are some of the implications?
One of the most interesting trends is the strong return of industrial policy in many parts of the world. Many governments are targeting the energy industry to establish leadership in clean technologies and supply chains, offering a wide range of support, including subsidies, tax incentives, state protection, and research and development support. This is not strange to China. China's industrial policy has been key in shaping its dominance in solar and mineral supply chains. I think an important recent shift has been the US embrace of green industrial policy. The Inflation Reduction Act in the US is designed to improve US economic competitiveness, innovation, and industrial productivity, and establish the country as a leader in the clean technology space. And in response, we have seen the EU proposing the Net Zero Industry Act to accelerate the domestic manufacturing of renewable technologies. And I believe this trend is likely to accelerate across the world. But to me, this raises key questions about the changing nature of competition, the pace of technological diffusion and collaboration, the impact this would have on countries that have the renewables and mineral resources, but don't have the capability to join the technological race through offering subsidies and incentives for their industries. But there's also the question whether will we see more protectionism. Protectionist policies could lead to countries producing renewable components domestically, even if it's not the most efficient or the cost-effective place to do so. And this could result in higher cost and potentially slower deployment of clean technologies. Protectionist policies also might reduce cooperation, possibly slowing down the pace of innovation and technological breakthroughs, which are necessary for a faster energy transition.
Okay, Bassam, let's end up this podcast by talking about the wider geopolitical context, if we may. Is it having an impact on the transition?
Well, the world has become more geopolitically polarized after the Russia-Ukraine war. As well, one needs to take into account the deterioration in China-US relations. Also, there's the divergence between the global north and the global south, which has become wider due to a number of issues, including finance, loss and damage. There's also a strong drive among countries to limit dependency on foreign sources of energy and minerals, and to relocate and localize supply chains and move away from globalized energy supply chains. Therefore, at a time when the world is going through a major transformation in its energy system and where cooperation climate action is most needed, the geopolitical context has become more fragmented and competition has intensified. This is likely to shape climate action going forward and raises key questions about the effectiveness of the COP process and the COP framework to tackle climate change and deliver on the Paris Agreement.
Well, Bassam, thank you so much for your time today. I really enjoyed our conversation on the key issues facing the energy transition. Now, as I said at the beginning of this podcast, this is the first of two podcasts that we're recording in September on this important subject, the energy transition. Now, in the second podcast, to be published soon, we will address the role of renewables, electricity, and electrical market design, as well as financing and finance institutions, before addressing the key features of the transition. And as I said earlier, asking the million-dollar question, where we are and how is the world dealing with climate change? So I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.